From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we'll look at the Akashic Records, perhaps yours. Here's what's happening. About 717,000 pounds of ConAgra brand spaghetti and meatball products, including Chef Boyardee, are being recalled. Oh, boy. The products contain milk, which is an allergen for many consumers, but the labels do not specify that the items contain milk. An ingredient supplier notified ConAgra that the breadcrumbs used in the spaghetti and meatballs included milk as an ingredient, so off the shelves they go. Bill Cosby's lawyer called accuser Andrea Constand a liar during his nearly two-hour-long closing argument in the comedian's sexual assault trial. The prosecution countered that claim in its own two-hour closing argument of that. Now it's up to the jury. They have been deliberating tonight. The star could spend the rest of his life behind bars. If convicted, we shall see. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled in part against President Donald Trump's so-called travel ban, upholding an injunction that prevents the administration from enforcing a suspension on travel from six mostly Muslim countries. NBA Hall of Famer Dennis Rodman expected to arrive in North Korea in moments. He's on his way again. CNN spotted Rodman at the Beijing International Airport, where he declined to answer questions. Rodman would be arriving in North Korea at a time of heightened tension between the United States and North Korea, which is currently detaining four Americans. It is unclear what the purpose of Rodman's visit to the very secretive country could be, but the eccentric former basketball player and a former contestant on Donald Trump's pre-presidency reality show Celebrity Apprentice is one of the only Americans to have met with current North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. And a top expert has claimed that North Korea's military is now just one step away from launching a nuke-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the United States. I'm going to bring in the expert, Charles R. Smith. Charles, all this rhetoric about North Korea building that kind of a missile, what's your take on all this?
Well, building an ICBM is somewhat a difficult task. You really just can't shortcut it from short-range missiles to super long-range missiles overnight. They have orbited stuff before, so if you put something into orbit, you can strike any point on Earth. That's right. As far as the North possessing a operational ICBM, unlikely. As far as them being able to obtain one in, say, the next 4 to 5 years, very possible. But they're going to have to go through an extensive testing and very rigorous process. And, of course, they've done that with their short-range missiles. So don't be too shocked and or surprised to see many tests starting to take place, where splashdowns are going to be thousands of miles out in the Pacific instead of a couple of hundred.
Okay, do you think the Trump administration has asked Dennis Rodman to go into North Korea?
It's quite possible. I know it sounds almost like a plot from, say, Futurama, where we have the Harlem Globetrotters and Dennis Rodman working to negotiate in sensitive international relations with a rather freaky dictator, but some of the oddest things in this world seem to work. I wish him luck if that is indeed his goal. At the same time, you know, I'm somewhat skeptical, but then again, it's quite possible he may come back with a couple of the Americans that are being currently held by the North Koreans, maybe as a show.
That would be a good sign. Okay, Charles, we're going to check in with you later on this week. I have a feeling more will be breaking. Well, phone addiction, they say, is a serious thing. It's called phubbing. It is a combination of phone and snubbing that occurs when conversation is interrupted by attention being given to a smartphone rather than the person that you're with. And when it's your loved one who bears the brunt of this compulsive action, it's called phubbing. partner phone snubbing. It's a phenomenon directly resulting from the emergence of phone addiction. So if you're out to dinner, put the phone away, at least for the dinner. Alien life could be discovered within the next 2 decades, but these life forms will be far from intelligent beings. According to one expert, according to astronomer Chris Impey, who's been on Coast to Coast, scientists are likely on the verge of detecting microbes on a planet beyond our own. That's still a pretty cool story. Let's check in. What else is going on in the skies? Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hey, Dr. Sky.
Hello there, George. Hey, so many cool things happening. George has just reported here. Maybe microbial life. Maybe on one of the moons of Jupiter, particularly Europa. But as we scan the skies, George, looking for this great eclipse that's coming, only 70 days away to the Great American Total Solar Eclipse, I made a commitment to update our audience every week with little tidbits of useful information. An eclipse like this, George, is most intensely emotional and a memorable event, of course. And naturally, the eclipse is happening in August, and it's a great month for vacations and people traveling, and school maybe hasn't started for the kids. But the big concern is weather. NOAA today, George, just came out with their eclipse forecast for August the 21st. Now, I don't want to alarm the audience, but they're saying areas on the East Coast may be in some thick clouds. Best locations, at least from that forecast, which could be not totally accurate, says that the western states may be best. 12 million people live in this area of totality, that 70-mile-wide strip, and estimates are that some between 2 and 8 million people, George, are going to be driving by car. Santee, South Carolina, along Interstate 95, and you know, folks, where that is, that alone has the distinction, George, of being the closest destination by car for some 75 million Americans. So they're saying if you're preparing for an eclipse expedition, prepare for huge traffic jams. Weather conditions are not the only concern. Food and water, it will be like a Woodstock on steroids. St. Joseph, Missouri, Casper, Wyoming, places in Idaho, over 55% of the nation is within 400 miles of totality. But George, quickly in the live sky, this is something great. The planet Saturn that we've been talking about for a long time rises in the southeast. It's at opposition on the 15th, meaning it rises at sunset. Now is a great time, folks, for the fans of Coast, to look to that region before the moon rises. You'll get to see the summer Milky Way in all of its splendor. Saturn lies in a constellation called Ophiuchus, hard enough to pronounce, sometimes referred to as the 13th sign of the zodiac. And George, any eclipse questions? I love them, and thank all the Coast listeners. It's just Dr. Sky, D-R-S-K-Y, D-R-S-K-Y, at Cox.net. Always remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
And tomorrow night, you're going to be one of our guests on our Coast Insiders chat.
Well, this is an awesome moment, George, and I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely.
You can be on with me. Your role starts at 8:30 p.m. Pacific time, so we'll see you then, Steve.
Looking forward to it.
That'll be fun. I'll tell you more about that a little bit later on tonight. Virtual reality, unbelievable technology, where a person can look around the artificial world and it's like he or she really is in it. Up next, we're going to be talking about practical augmented reality on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, our guest for the next couple hours, Steve Oxtecolnis, is a research scientist, consultant, author of several books on virtual and augmented reality. Now, he's spent more than 2 decades working on the application of head-mounted displays and other advanced human-computer interfaces in areas like engineering, education, defense, and entertainment. And here he is. He's the author of Practical Augmented Reality. That title alone tells me a lot, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, George. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
My God, I've been looking at virtual reality all day today on the internet. It's amazing where it has come in 15 years.
Yeah, it really has. There's been so many major advances in the component technologies that are enabling just some phenomenal applications right now, and I'm sure we'll get through a number of these as this conversation goes on.
I'm betting, producer Tom, that you're either Greek or Lithuanian.
Lithuanian.
I knew it! I knew it. I had a buddy at the University of Detroit whose last name ended with N-I-S, and he was Lithuanian. That's how I knew. How about that?
I was actually there over the New Year and saw some phenomenal virtual reality stuff while in the country there. So
explain what virtual reality and augmented reality is, and what's the difference between the two?
So virtual and augmented reality, these are often parts of the same conversation, though there's significant differences between the two technologies. The first, virtual reality, is a completely computer-generated replacement to one's true visual and audio surroundings. Now, the way that this experience is delivered to the user is through what's called a head-mounted display. So in front of each eye, you have a small flat panel display screen and special optics that spread the imagery to cover most of your vertical and horizontal fields of view. There's sensors in the display or elsewhere in the room that track the position and orientation of your head so the computer knows where you're looking and it in turn can draw the correct images. While what the user experiences is the visual sensation of being immersed into a computer-generated environment that you can freely explore, as opposed to being on the outside looking in, such as on a standard desktop computer monitor. So a really great example to illustrate this is an architectural walkthrough. Mm-hmm. Where you're able to physically walk through the interior of a building design months before the construction process even begins. Now, this is already being done at architectural firms around the world.
And it's like you're there, isn't it?
It really is. The sensation of presence, if it's set up correctly and so on, is very compelling. So that's virtual reality. Augmented reality is very different. Here you also wear a head-mounted viewing device, but these are generally referred to as optical see-through displays. So they're typically much smaller in size. They allow you to see your real-world surroundings, but with text, symbols, or graphical information inserted into that view, which ideally holds some real-time relationship with what you're looking at. And so, as an example for this, imagine you're a general aviation pilot. You walk out to your Cessna aircraft, and you put on one of these displays, and you see a highway in the sky that represents your intended flight path,
mm-hmm.
or small icons representing the true position of other aircraft around you, or even semi-transparent columns that you see in the distance that go from maybe ground level up to 50,000 feet that represent restricted airspace. So this is augmented reality, or what in some implementations is referred to as mixed reality.
What application is being used mostly in video gaming? Is it virtual reality?
It is the virtual reality at the present time. There are literally hundreds of companies around the world that are designing fully immersive single-person and multi-person gaming applications where you put on the head-mounted display and the action is taking place all the way around you. You know, shoot 'em up games all the way through, games of skill, driving simulators, and so on. But at the present time, most of this is taking place using the fully immersive virtual reality systems.
There must be big money in this, Stephen, because Apple is jumping in against Microsoft and Google to be leaders in the reality, the augmented reality especially. Are they going to make a lot of money doing this?
They will. But it needs to be understood that we're still in the crawling stage of the application of these technologies in these areas. The displays need to become more refined and smaller in size. The actual state of the art, or the best practices for designing these environments so that the perceptual effects are correct, you know, what is most engaging with the people and all that. All the game designers are currently, I don't want to say struggling with this, but they're trying to identify what exactly is it that you can draw people in time after
right.
time after time to come back to the games.
If somebody is blind, will they ever get the technology where with electrodes hooked up to their brain, they would virtually be able to see?
That is the hope, and there's actually a lot of work being done in this area where there are implants that are put in, and depending upon what the visual condition is, but they're already to the point where they can allow somebody to perceive several individual points of light. This is as far as they've gotten so far, but
it'll get
there. I would think a few decades down the line, they'll probably be able to go far beyond that.
Now, is VR at a sophisticated point now where the person who's wearing the headsets and the eyepieces could, let's say, carry on a discussion with a virtual reality image of a person, and that image would talk back to that person?
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
You know, smart agents, you know, the incorporation of AI into this. You know, for instance, there's applications right now where you put on the head-mounted display, you're in this little cartoon world, and a little computer-generated puppy will run up to you, and you can start to play games with it.
You know, and pat it, ball, and pat it, and everything
the
else.
Ball and bring it back to you.
Now, will the images look like cartoons, or will they look lifelike?
It, in part, depends upon how it's designed. Some people, or some of the game designers, want things to appear cartoonish, and then there are others that are trying to rapidly approach photorealism as quickly as they can. But the challenge with this is that the more realistic you make the models that people are going to be moving around in, the more computationally intensive it is. And so as the computing power, graphics, horsepower, step-by-step increases, clearly the visual fidelity and realism of these simulations will dramatically increase as well.
Well, we've got some graphics that Steve has sent us that are up at coasttocoastam.com, so if you get a moment, go up there and take a look at this. Initially, when VR was started, Steve, and I remember this was years and years and years ago, it was primarily for gaming only, and then it intensified, it's changed. How much is it being used now for military or defense applications?
There's extensive use of it within the Defense Department and other organizations that will support the warfighter. And if you'd like, we can get into some of these.
Yeah, give us right some now. Ideas, sure.
So let me tell you about three of them.
All right.
That are pretty intriguing. So most of the listeners are probably already familiar with helmet-mounted displays that are used by fighter jet and helicopter pilots, where they see the normal cockpit avionics and weapons information that's visible on the inside of the visors or on special optical elements in front of their eyes. But the applications go much further. For instance, there's several branches of the armed services that are using a skydiving simulator known as Parasim. Now, in the system, the user puts on a harness and a head-mounted display, and you're winched into a rack. When the simulation begins, the user sees a high-quality, computer-generated version of what they would actually be seeing during a jump.
Wow.
They can control the virtual parachute they're using with toggles that they're holding in their hands. You can vary the weather conditions or the terrain models, as well as the type of canopy that you're jumping under. And since these are physics-based simulations, the quality of the visuals, the response of the canopy as you're pulling on the toggles this way and that way, it's very realistic. And these systems can be used for single users to refine particular skills, such as clearing a canopy malfunction, as well as groups of soldiers, all of whom can see each other in the same simulation, who need to practice a
Amazing.
Specific mission.
They could even hold hands like they were all jumping, right?
Potentially.
Yeah.
Getting more down to earth, the second application is referred to as the Dismounted Soldier Training System. Now, this is used by the U.S. Army in multiple places around the world. And what it's designed to do is refine squad and team tactics in such activities as room clearing and building clearing operations. How do you move a 9-man rifle squad around different types of obstacles and so on? And all of this can take place as opposed to taking up a big piece of a base where you're having everybody run around
right.
over multiple square miles. If you've got 1,600 feet of space and access to electricity, you can wire up 9 individuals that are all in the same simulation. They each see each other in the same simulation, and they can maneuver through these different tasks, and then you can go back afterwards and analyze what they've done right, what they've done wrong.
They may have done that when they got Osama bin Laden. They may have trained with something like that.
There is a very good chance that tools like this were used for that operation and a lot of other ones.
Amazing. Okay, and what's the third application?
Now, the third application, this is one of my favorites, and you have images on your website that illustrate what I'm talking about. Now, there's a system that's currently in testing by NASA, and it's a flying flight simulator. So in the system, the pilot puts on a head-mounted display, and it has a camera sticking out of the front. That camera films the inside of the cockpit and streams those images back to the pilot. But the cool part is that they're able to insert computer-generated images into the windows.
Hold on, Steve. Let's pick that up when we come back as we talk about virtual reality and augmented reality. The big computer giants, they're all fighting to get there. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Saturday, July 29th, as now the clock is ticking in Everett, Washington, we are going to have a live stage show. Four incredible guests, a meet and greet after, some special music and a few surprises. So come on down. You know, originally I said, if you're in the Northwest Corridor, come on over. Now come over from everyone because people are coming from South Carolina, Florida, Michigan. They're coming, so you might as well too. How do you get tickets? Go to coasttocoastam.com. Click the fourth highlight button right there on the homepage. That'll get you to it. Or call 425-258-6766. That's 425-258-6766. Or simply Google Historic Everett Theater. Welcome back. We're back with Steve Oxtokolnis. His book is called Practical Augmented Reality. We're talking about AR and VR, virtual reality. And boy, those big computer giants really are fighting to get into this in a big way, Steve.
They really are. Most of the major corporations participating in the consumer electronic fields are involved in research and development or release of their own products or partnering with other companies in order to bring their computing systems together with the different component technologies. But everybody sees the vast potential that these technologies hold, and they're trying to establish a footprint.
That's exciting. Now, you were talking about that third aspect, the application, about that had to do with flights. I'll let you finish that up.
So we were talking about, this is a flying flight simulator that NASA's been working on. And as I mentioned, in this one, the pilot puts on a head-mounted display that has a camera sticking out of the front. That camera films the inside of the cockpit and streams those images immediately back to the pilot. But the computing system will insert computer-generated images into the windows. So, for instance, the pilots can practice touch-and-goes at 5,000 feet, or they can practice formation flying or aerial refueling operations, even though they might be the only aircraft in the sky for miles around. Now, in each of these defense examples that I've given, one of the key overarching benefits is that the users can practice a variety of extremely complex or dangerous tasks, but without negative consequences if they make a mistake. So, for instance, if you fly your aircraft into the side of the virtual tanker, you just start the simulation again.
You're not going to blow up or anything like that.
And you might be asking, why can't they run these same simulations in a normal flight simulator on the ground? And the answer to that is that it's extremely difficult to simulate phenomena like energy bleed and variable G-forces. But by putting the simulation capability into an actual aircraft, those forces are there, and they add that much more realism to the practice exercises. And if you were to talk to any of the pilots that have tried this, they say that they're coming back drenched in sweat because it's just so real.
Yeah, that's amazing. If somebody, for example, jumps out of a plane in a virtual reality jump and doesn't pull their parachute, in a virtual reality jump, would they crash? Would they see their bodies hit the ground, just smash like they're coming down?
I don't think that they would certainly see, you know, themselves to the point where...
But they'd be tumbling, right?
They would be tumbling. It's all in how the simulation is designed. For instance, if you descend below a certain altitude and so on, you probably just have a red screen that comes up, you know, that says you're going to auger in. But again, it all depends upon how the programmers have set up the simulation, and that the goal is to, with, for instance, the Parasim system, is to teach quality skills and give people a chance to refine the skill set without scaring them.
Well, I was going to say, if it's so realistic, could somebody die of a heart attack?
I think that's a very distinct possibility and probably a growing possibility as the fidelity of the images and the physics of the simulation become more and more real. If you can elicit, you know, an endorphin release or an adrenaline release to the point where, you know, you're bathed in sweat and so on, I think you're starting to move towards that.
My gosh. Now, why would somebody want to go through that? What kind of jolly would they get by going through a simulation where they could potentially die of a heart attack because it's so realistic?
Well, this, again, would be incumbent upon the content designers to not take it to a point that, you know, would elicit that much of a response, but
we know they will.
The benefits of using simulation technologies, for instance, in the flying flight simulator, if you're able to go up with just two people inside of an aircraft and practice these different maneuvers instead of having to have an actual tanker that's flying with a crew or other aircraft in the sky constantly in order to help you refine the skill sets, there's a dramatic reduction in cost. You have a dramatically increased opportunity to practice and practice and practice and refine the skill set, without the normal associated dangers or the expense.
Is your dexterity does it get better as you do this in a virtual world?
Absolutely, it does. And that ability to refine skill sets like that, these tangible skills, it only gets better as the technologies advance. And so as position sensors get more accurate so they can accurately reflect where your hand would be and what it's manipulating inside of the virtual environment, there would clearly be a benefit that would transfer to the skills. And as we get to, for instance, talking about the educational benefits of this, I'll give you some solid examples of how that's actually taking place.
It's just amazing technology. It's exciting. Do you see the day where Hollywood, where they give out 3D glasses at movies, would give out headsets to everybody?
All of the above. Now, this is perhaps one of the most intriguing application areas for these technologies within the entertainment industry. So right now, nearly every major Hollywood studio and a bunch of the smaller ones are experimenting with a new class of cameras, which film in 360, or what we can loosely refer to as spherical video.
Okay.
So, as opposed to a standard movie camera, which captures imagery in a single direction, these new systems capture footage 360 degrees around the camera in stereo. And this new video footage is intended to be played back using a virtual reality headset. And so filmmaking professionals know that they have an immensely powerful tool at hand, but they're just now beginning to explore how to harness its capabilities and how to actually work with it. For instance, if you're filming 360 degrees, how do you light a scene? You know, where do the technicians stand, the people with the microphones and all that? And if you think about the length of time that it took for filmmaking to evolve over 100 years, covering everything from camera position, movement through a scene, framing a shot, how to guide a viewer's eyes and attention around a frame, all of this has to be reinvented with this new medium. And Hollywood they're pouring considerable amount of time, effort, and resources into trying to harness exactly, you know, how to get this new medium off the ground. Whether or not it's going to be getting 500 people inside of an auditorium and everybody putting on a head-mounted display, or we can take, for instance, let's use Netflix as an example. Maybe you're downloading these to your home computer,
right.
And viewing them in your home, but because you might miss something behind you, you go back and watch it again and so on and change your viewpoints. They don't really know how, because the science behind this is just now starting to be explored. They don't know what the ultimate implementation is going to be, but there's tremendous effort going in to try and discover that.
Could you even put yourself in the movie?
Quite possibly. There's efforts underway to try and develop the means to allow your actions to determine which way the plot goes. But again, this is still at the budding phase, and so there, this and other things are constantly being explored right now. But to illustrate just the importance of it, the recent Tribeca Film Festival, the Sundance Film Festival, yeah, they're all now incorporating different segments of those gatherings where people are showing their initial efforts using these technologies. And some of the stuff is extremely impressive.
As technology gets sophisticated, it tends to get smaller. Is that happening in the virtual world too?
It absolutely is, and this is the direction that everybody would like to see all of this go. Right now, everything is it's big. It hangs off the front of your face.
Is it bulky?
It is bulky. So one of the primary reasons that the displays are as large as they currently are is because of the actual flat panel display screens that are used. They have to be positioned within a few inches of the eyes. And as we're unable to focus on something that close, you then have to add special optics. Then there's the associated electronics that go to driving the display screens, the different housings that hold it all together in a firm position, the different sensors that are used. But over the next, I would say, 3 to 4 years, there's a new class of displays that are currently being developed that will start to be released into the market that are using different imaging technologies that'll begin to bring the size of these units down considerably. And one of the ways that this will be accomplished is by using the retina of the eye as the imaging surface. So another way to say this is that the images will either be projected or reflected into the eyes, thus dramatically reducing the number of large, bulky pieces that have to be hung in front of the face.
Steve, what about educational applications where you could train someone to be a dentist, to drill on a virtual tooth, or a heart surgeon to work on a virtual operation where he's really not even cutting into somebody, he's doing it virtually, and he's learning just as much?
You know, George, some would argue that this is perhaps one of the most powerful uses of these technologies. Let me give you some examples.
Okay.
So starting at the professional level, every astronaut heading to the International Space Station spends dozens of hours using fully immersive virtual reality systems to practice different tasks such as assembly and repair procedures, how to operate different experiments, and even how to move large, high-mass objects around in a microgravity environment. Then we have companies, for instance, and I was alluding to this earlier in a conversation about learning tangible skills, where we have companies like Lincoln Electric who have developed a virtual reality-based arc welding simulator that's now being used in trade schools around the world to supplement the more traditional tangible skills educational methods. And it's interesting to note that those training on these systems test out as good, if not better, than those who have been trained exclusively using the more traditional techniques. At the university level, there's many architecture schools that now incorporate the use of virtual reality as part of the curriculum in order to help the students develop a balance or a concordance between what they mentally envision the interior space of a building looking like and what they actually end up communicating in the form of CAD models and construction.
That's exciting. Could you teach somebody to be a marksman through virtual reality?
I don't think at the present time that the precision of the simulations is enough to help refine marksmanship skills.
Okay.
But it's coming.
Yeah. Now, tell me about the growth. You know, like in the computer age, every year they kind of double and things get faster and things move along. Is it the same thing with the virtual world?
Not by a country mile, no.
It's slower.
It's much slower, and the industry has been dealing with, it's very similar to the which came first, the chicken or the egg. So the hardware manufacturers want to see great content developed before they start to invest massive amounts of money into the development of, you know, really unique displays. On the other side, the software developers, because it can cost tens of millions of dollars just to make one gaming title, they don't want to invest that money until the great displays are there. And so what's been happening is that there's been kind of a meeting of the minds, and there's a concurrent push on both sides in order to move things along. But the growth in this industry, the advancement of the industry and the individual component technologies is much, much slower than regular computing technologies.
If real life were considered 100%, if you wanted to go to London, for example, or France, and a physical visit to see Big Ben or the Eiffel Tower was 100% by being there, what would virtual reality be in terms of that percent? How close can you get to reality if you're in a virtual world, like you were there?
Pretty significant, and let me explain. This will circle back to the educational application. Right. So Google has a major program underway called the Explorers Program, within which inexpensive smartphone-based virtual reality headsets can be used to take entire classrooms of students on virtual field trips to more than 100 different locations around the world, including Antarctica, the Acropolis of Athens, the Great Wall of China, or even diving off the Great Barrier Reef, and they're not even leaving the classroom. And Google, what they're doing is leveraging other products that they have. For instance, Street View. You know, they've developed ways to take, you know, those real images and the 3D models and bring them in to allow somebody, for instance, to walk down the street past Big Ben,
mm-hmm.
or to walk along the top of the Great Wall of China. And so they're using existing stuff in an educational application that has tremendous photorealism to it, because they're actual photos, and the effect is extremely compelling. You have a very, very, very strong sensation of actually having a presence there.
Can they get it to the point where in a virtual world you could have somebody jump out of the bushes at gunpoint and rob you, and it will feel as if it's really happening?
If you can program it and model it, you can do it.
They can do it.
Yes.
Wow. Where do you see, Stephen, the benefit of this application?
Of what application?
Of either virtual or augmented reality. Where do you see it really headed?
So we've already talked about the strength of its use in simulation within the defense sector. We've already covered the strengths of the application of these technologies within the educational sector. Industry is also making huge use of initially augmented reality, but virtual reality has a heavy presence as well. So for instance, Lockheed Martin, literally every large product that they produce now is first simulated in virtual reality so that they can do design exploration, looking for defects in the assembly process, where technicians are supposed to be standing. Ford Motor Company, just a couple months ago, I was visiting their ergonomics lab in Dearborn, and they use it to prototype assembly lines for new automobiles, you know, even mm-hmm. a couple years before they yeah. actually start the construction.
They were way ahead of the game.
And the net result is that if you can identify problems early on in the design phase, as opposed to after the facility has been built, there's dramatic savings, and it's a lot easier to change a design than to start pulling up things that you've bolted to the ground, have to break cement, and so on.
All right, hold on, Steve. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more about this with your book, Practical Augmented Reality, and we will take phone calls. What an amazing subject. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.